pop up.
Okay. I'm going to go through my presentation sort of as presented, as if this was a relatively tight session. And so you may have questions about it afterwards, but it sounds like we'll have plenty of time for discussion if anything goes by too fast for you. Okay, well, good morning. I'm going to be presenting a study we did using the New York Citywide Immunization Registry to assess effectiveness of 2009 H1N1 influenza A monovalent vaccine at preventing hospitalization of children with PH1N1 influenza infection. Well, pandemic influenza A, H1N1 2009, which I'll refer to as PH1N1, presented an opportunity and challenge to exercise pandemic preparedness plans. Often missing from our local response plans, but an important aspect of pandemic influenza response and evaluation is to determine the effectiveness of pandemic influenza vaccine against the pandemic strain, especially if vaccine is in continued short supply. Knowledge of the effectiveness in different age groups can help guide and modify recommendations for its use. New York City was hit hard early by PH1N1, beginning with a large high school outbreak in late April 2009 that rapidly seeded other parts of the city. By mid-July 2009, more than 1,200 persons had been hospitalized with confirmed PH1N1, and of those hospitalized, 32% were children less than 10 years of age. This slide shows the epidemic curve of hospitalizations with PH1N1 in New York City during the first wave. The pandemic spread quickly, with peak activity occurring in late May. As the first PH1N1 wave progressed, national efforts were underway to develop, produce, and conduct immunogenicity studies of PH1N1 vaccine. An initial question was, would one or two doses of vaccine be needed to provide high protection against severe disease? In this context, the ACIP recommends a two-dose primary series for children less than 9 years for seasonal influenza strains, and for pandemic strains to which they have no pre-existing immunity, even adults might need two doses. And this has been particularly a prominent discussion around H5N1. The results of pre-licensing serological studies were interesting. It appeared that a single dose of PH1N1 vaccine resulted in potentially protective level immunity in most recipients, but that this was age-related. Greater than 90% of persons 10 years and older developed potentially protective titers, 75% to 87% of children 3 to 9-year-olds appeared protected, but only 44% of children 6 months to 2 years appeared protected. Based on the results of these studies, the ACIP recommended the schedule shown in this slide: one dose for those 10 and older, a two-dose series for children 6 months to 9 years of age. The recommendations were silent on whether some children should get their second dose before all had a chance to get a first dose. Vaccine first became available nationally for ordering, at least, in late September 2009, after the second pandemic wave had begun. Children were a focus for initial vaccination. In New York City, the first vaccine shipments were received during the first week of October. I'd now like to focus on the situation that provided the opportunity for the study. The New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene decided to carry out an intensive vaccination campaign to reach all children and young adults for whom the vaccine was initially recommended. As part of this, the City Health Department decided to take an active role in vaccination efforts and fully monitor them. To these ends, it organized school-located clinics in all public and most private elementary schools, organized points of distribution or pods for older children and eligible adults, and distributed vaccine to all interested providers. Efforts to make an initial dose of vaccine available to all children through school-located clinics began on October 28th and ended on November 24th. Beginning December 1st, another round of school-located clinics began to administer the second recommended dose. For accountability and evaluation, all PH1N1 doses administered were required to be reported to and entered into the New York City Citywide Immunization Registry, which I'll from here on refer to as the CIR. The CIR is one of the nation's largest immunization registries. There's been mandatory reporting of all immunizations given to all persons less than 19 years of age since 2005. There are 4.4 million records of persons with over 51 million immunization events. VSC vaccine dose level accountability is done using CIR data. Consequently, pediatric providers are very familiar with it. Beginning in April 2009, in response to the recognition of PH1N1, hospitals were required to report anyone hospitalized with laboratory-confirmed influenza. The City Health Department offered typing of influenza A on any relevant specimen submitted from a hospitalized person. Hospitalization surveillance continued through March 30, 2010, when P1H1 activity essentially ceased. The combination of surveillance for hospitalizations plus efforts to capture all PH1N1 vaccinations provided the opportunity to assess PH1N1 vaccine effectiveness in preventing hospitalizations. This slide shows the epidemic curve of PH1N1 hospitalizations in children less than 10 years and the timeline of school-located vaccination efforts from October 2009 through March 2010. By the time the first round of clinics had ended and the second had begun, around December 1st, peak activity had occurred, although there continued to be hospitalizations through the end of March. So our study had several objectives. First, to determine the effectiveness of a single dose of PH1N1 vaccine, a monovalent vaccine, in preventing hospitalization with PH1N1 influenza in children 7 months to 9 years old. Second, to determine vaccine effectiveness with minimal resources by using CIR. This study would not have been undertaken had there not been a childhood immunization registry. So we conducted a case control study using data on vaccination status from the CIR. No other source of information was used to determine vaccination status, thus no patient contact was needed. To be included as a case, a child needed to meet the following criteria: age 7 months to 9 years, reported to the New York City Department of Health as being hospitalized in a New York City hospital with laboratory confirmed PH1N1 infection any time between December 1st, 2009 and March 31st, 2010, and have a record in the CIR with evidence of active reporting of childhood vaccinations. Active reporting was defined as having at least one non-influenza vaccine given other than a birth dose of hepatitis B vaccine. Controls were selected from the CIR. They had to have evidence of active reporting of childhood vaccinations. 10 controls were matched to each case by date of birth and zip code of residence. PH1N1 vaccination status was determined as follows: only vaccination data in the CIR and a single PH1N1 vaccine dose were considered. A child was considered vaccinated if the dose was given at least 14 days prior to the date of hospitalization of the matched case. If a dose was given less than 14 days prior to the date of hospitalization of the matched case or given later, it was recorded as no vaccination. There were several notable exclusion criteria. Cases that were not registered in the CIR were excluded. Both cases and controls in the CIR were excluded if they did not meet the criterion of active reporting to the CIR. In addition, if either a case or control that was selected had been given a second dose at least 7 days before hospitalization, they were excluded. This exclusion occurred after initial control selection. Data was collected on several other variables thought to possibly be associated with opportunity to receive PH1N1 vaccine, as listed on this slide: VFC eligible at the last vaccine entry in the CIR, up to date for age for all required childhood immunizations, 2009 seasonal influenza vaccination, and whether the most recent provider, as recorded in the CIR, had received a supply of PH1N1 vaccine. We broke down calculation of vaccine effectiveness into two age groups, 7 to 35 months and 3 to 9 years. We did this because pre-licensing serological studies showed different potential effectiveness. VE was calculated in the standard way, using the formula 1 minus the odds ratio of cases compared to controls being vaccinated, and then multiplying by 100% to turn it into a percentage. We calculated the unmatched odds ratio and also the Mantel-Hansel summary odds ratios after stratification by possibly influencing variables with unequal distribution between cases and controls. Overall, 82 cases met CIR criteria. 4 were excluded because they had received a second dose at least 7 days before hospitalization. Among the 78 fully eligible cases, 33 were 7 to 35 months old, and 45 were 3 to 9 years old. 780 controls were matched to the 78 cases. 51 were excluded because they had received a second dose at least 7 days before hospitalization of the matched case, leaving 729 fully eligible. Of these, 313 were 7 to 35 months, and 416 were 3 to 9 years old. This slide shows the month of hospitalization of the 78 cases. While the majority were hospitalized in December, there were still cases occurring in January through March as H1N1 activity smoldered. This later activity contributed to the need to exclude cases and controls who had time to receive two doses of vaccine. Okay, this somewhat busy slide shows a comparison of cases and controls for the selected vaccine access characteristics by age group. In general, they did not differ from each other by these characteristics, with one exception, VFC eligibility status, shown in the red font. For 3 to 9-year-olds, controls were more likely than cases to have unknown VFC status. This slide shows the data underlying the VE calculations for 7 to 35-month-old children. As shown in purple, case children were as likely as control children to be vaccinated, 12.1% and 11.8%, respectively. Thus, the relevant odds ratio is 1.03, and the point estimate of vaccine effectiveness is 0. This slide shows the data underlying the VE calculations for 3 to 9-year-olds. Tells a different story. As shown in purple, case children were much less likely than control children to be vaccinated, 2.2% versus 11.3%. Thus, the relevant odds ratio is 0.18, and the point estimate of VE is 82%, an effectiveness that's statistically significant. We conducted several other analyses of vaccine effectiveness. When we did a matched analysis, we came up with the same point estimates of VE. We also came up with the same result when we stratified by whether a child was VFC eligible, up to date with other vaccinations, or received seasonal trivalent influenza vaccine in the fall of 2009. These VE findings are consistent with pre-licensing serological studies, although the absence of protection in 7 to 35-month-olds was not expected. We believe these findings have several implications. First, regarding vaccination against PH1N1, they suggest that children less than 3 years with only one dose should be a high priority to get a full primary two-dose series. For children 3 to 9 years old, it may not be so important to give a primary series of two doses in the same year. Second, we think that for future pandemics, those setting priorities for initial vaccination should consider a more refined look at young children and making recommendations in priority setting. In particular, if the serologic response to new pandemic strains is different between pediatric age groups, this should be taken into account when setting priorities for who should get two doses quickly. Let's see. We also have a point to make about immunization registries. Determining a vaccine's effectiveness once licensed is important, particularly for vaccines licensed solely based on immunogenicity studies and for groups such as children for whom the number of doses is a concern. Immunization registries can be used to rapidly assess effectiveness with minimum additional resources. Notably, this study could have been completed within 2 to 3 weeks of all vaccination data being in the CIR. No patient contact was needed, and there is the potential to optimize power. There are many potential controls. Further, head-to-head comparison of immunization registry-based to classical case control studies for pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, 7-valent vaccine, and for rotavirus vaccine effectiveness have given similar results, including in registries with less than average participation rates. For possible doubters, the potential exists to replicate or expand the study with other immunization registries. This study has some notable limitations. Most importantly, given the low vaccination rates, we had very limited statistical power. Thus, there are very wide confidence intervals around our VE estimates. Second, there are limitations inherent to immunization registry-based VE studies. We have no data on controls for underlying conditions. We cannot determine vaccine effectiveness among subgroups defined by underlying conditions, for example, obesity or asthma. In addition, we don't know which or how many controls had previous H1N1 infection and whether they had a different vaccination rate than uninfected controls. Finally, this was a study of protection against hospitalization. It was not a study to determine protection against getting any PH1N1 infection. So to conclude, we found a different level of protection against hospitalization with PH1N1 infection following a single dose of monovalent PH1N1 vaccine among young children, with 3 to 9-year-olds being highly protected, while less than 3-year-olds were not protected. We also demonstrated that immunization registries are a resource to examine vaccine effectiveness. Additional studies with additional vaccines are needed to further confirm the value of immunization registries for this purpose, and the potential exists to expand this study in locations with immunization registries with reporting of PH1N1 vaccination and surveillance for hospitalizations during the relevant time period. So I'd like to thank my co-authors from the New York City Bureau of Immunizations and Bureau of Communicable Diseases. And that.
Questions. We have time for questions because we only have 2 speakers. And so I'll start if that's okay. I was sitting on the other side.
Sure.
Wasn't abandoning you. I think this paper, to us at least, brings up lots of questions and lots of possibilities. I agree that using immunization registries to look at the effectiveness of flu vaccine each year, potentially a very powerful and inexpensive tool to do so, and I think that's becoming more important. In your study, I don't know anything about vaccine registries, but I thought I remember data from somewhere that seemed to imply that kids who have other vaccines registered, logged into registries are more likely to have been vaccinated against flu. And this is, I don't know where I saw this data, but assuming that kids who have more vaccines in registries are more likely to get vaccines, how would that have affected your ability to look at vaccine effectiveness? That is, if your cases and controls both had to have a certain level of vaccination registries, would it have reduced your chance to see an effective vaccine, or would it have?
Yeah, we partially did that. We did it sort of as kind of at least one versus all, in a sense. Number one, it's important to make sure that cases and controls have exactly the same selection criteria. So if you're selecting controls because it looks like they're well vaccinated and they're immunizations are being actively reported at the registry, you need to make sure that your cases have exactly the same characteristics because you're going to be using that data. But within that, we did start out with the criterion of having at least one immunization that wasn't the birth dose of hepatitis B, so it wasn't something reported when the child was born, and then the child was kind of lost from the registry purposes after that. Mm-hmm. So they had to have at least something else reported. So we started out with that criterion, and then within that, we looked at up-to-date for age versus not up to date. We could have stratified that more finely. We might have lost a little bit of power in the stratifications, potentially the point estimate at least would have been relevant.
Right. Questions, Jane?
It's a small group, so we can put it in more of a discussion.
Scream out, guys.
Well, I just want to address that point because actually other work that we did showed that over 90% of the vaccines that pediatrics, mm-hmm. pediatricians administered H1N1 vaccine, was 92% of those doses were actually reported to the registry.
Okay.
So I think that we got good data capture in terms of the vaccination status of the children.
Much bias and
so that was a separate analysis that we had done.
Nice.
Right. This is Jane Zucker, who's the head of the New York City Immunization Bureau of Immunization.
One of the other questions, while I've got moderator's prerogative, I guess, is you mentioned one of the limitations, which I think is key, and that is the inability to control for underlying diseases or reasons kids might either get vaccinated or get hospitalized. One way that we've approached it at CDC is to use hospitalized test negative controls. And you could probably do that in registries as well, you could, the same way you capture hospitalized flu-positive patients, you could walk down the hall and capture hospitalized flu-negative patients with respiratory disease or some other kind of patients, and then look for their vaccine status in registry. And by comparing hospitalized to hospitalized kids, you might be able to control for things that bring them to hospital other than flu, I guess. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think it is possible as long as you're using the same data sources for vaccination. You could select your control right. group in a different way, not necessarily from right. controls in the immunization registry in which you don't have additional information other than what's in the registry, mm-hmm. Unless you go and actively try to find those people, which, of course, that adds a level of complication right. and labor that many people don't necessarily want to do. But there's no reason you couldn't select hospitalized, non-influenza infected controls and get that information from the immunization registry. I know of one rotavirus vaccine effectiveness study. It's not published yet, but that has been contributed to by several of the emerging infections program that's mm-hmm. done that with rotavirus vaccine using several different control groups, one selected from the registry, one selected from rotavirus test negative individuals, all using immunization registry information, and they get the same
nice.
The same estimates of vaccine okay. effectiveness.
Okay. Okay.
So the advantage you might get from that is that you could find some of the other confounding factors like asthma or obesity from those kids that are hospitalized and the kids who are hospitalized with flu, so you could add that.
Right. It's possible with more work to do more, to do more things. I think the issue of trying to capture vaccine information, as long as you have a registry that at least has had systematic, not necessarily complete, but systematic reporting, so it's not really just sort of totally ad hoc reporting of any given vaccine to the registry. There's, cases and controls there, and the likelihood that their information is in the registry should be similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other questions? Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, I have one quick thing to mention since we have a tiny bit of extra time. One issue that's been raised is for our control group, and it's probably actually it's true for some of the other, for the control groups gotten from hospitalized controls, we don't really know who had previous PH1N1 infection, and therefore we might have people in the control group who are already immune. In theory, they shouldn't be in the control group if they're already immune. On the other hand, most people who had PH1N1 infection didn't have it confirmed, and mm-hmm. some people had it asymptomatically. And so it's difficult to, mm-hmm. It's a difficult yeah. issue to deal with. But ultimately, the question becomes, were people with previous PH1N1 infection differentially vaccinated than people without it?
Right.
So we did a little bit of a sort of an analysis of making a couple of assumptions, and you can see that actually I'll show you a couple of quick slides on the on the 3 to 9 year olds. This is what happens if you assume we actually did some estimates looking at different sources of immunity of kids in New York City, and feel that by the time we started doing the study, probably 40% of the children in New York City had already had PH1N1 infection. So that's like 40% of our controls are really sort of no good. So what happens if we make the assumption, at least hypothetically no good. So what happens if we make the assumption that these previously infected children were vaccinated at the same rate as cases? Basically, the lower part of this slide, let's see, this area, this shows the raw data using all controls. This shows the uninfected controls. Basically, you reduce these two numbers by, these two right here by 40%. Mm-hmm. You end up with exactly the same vaccination rate, of course, and your odds ratio is the same. You lose a little bit of power. P-value is a little bit nice. Lower. So let's assume that actually the previously infected children were vaccinated at only half the rate. And one could argue that there somebody who thinks they've already been infected might decide, I've already been infected. I don't need to be vaccinated. When you do that, these are the numbers. Again, you'll throw out 40% of the controls, but they're because of the differential vaccination. These are your numbers now. And actually, your power, the estimate of vaccine effectiveness goes up with a significant p-value. Then you can assume it the other way around, that people who were sick sometime during PH1N1, during the epidemic, who decided they were... because I was sick, even though I don't know what it was, and it might have been H1N1, but I'm going to get vaccinated because I was sick. I'm really worried about this. So they had sort of some positive reinforcement about possible preventing, something to prevent. So if you assume they were vaccinated at twice the rate, which is probably an improbable percentage, but nonetheless, let's assume they were done at twice the rate, these are the numbers you come up with. Then the vaccine effectiveness drops, but only to 74%. But your power, of course, given the level of vaccination, only 8.1% in the control group, isn't enough to say this is statistically significant.
That's great.
So that's just one way of trying to deal with that.
The big thing you don't have there is that after a certain percentage of time, the 40% susceptibility in the population is less too. It's like the herd immunity. I think a lot of people suspected that because of the first wave, places that were very heavily affected the first time, like New York City and the New England states, had a very milder attack rate the second time because there weren't as many people that were susceptible because your exposure was different. That's a big thing that now accounts for, even from that, looking at the vaccine effectiveness.
Sure, right, but the vaccine effectiveness itself shouldn't be affected by that directly because you're still having the cases and controls with the same risk of infection at the same time.
Yeah.
Even though it's a different sort of epidemic curve that you have. One is very sharp and goes up and down, and the other one is much more spread out. It's over time.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
Fantastic.